This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
An ox, a lamb, or a goat in the camp, outside the camp. That he doesn't bring the animal to the Mishkan, he brought to the sacrifice before Hashem. Then Dom Yechoshev lo ishavu, Dom Shokov, and blood will be considered for that man, blood is spilled, Rashi says, Keshepech dam ba'odo, Shemitzchayev benapshe, just as one who spills the blood of a human being is guilty of a capital offense, so this too is a capital offense. Then Nichra Parishahu Mikerev Amoy, and that people will be cut off from the midst of his nation. The question is, what is this issue exactly? What is the prohibition? Rabbi Yishmael says the prohibition is that one may not, at that time, have slaughtered an ox, a goat, or a lamb for any use other than the Beis Hamikdash, in the Mishkan. The only justification to slaughter a lamb was to use it as a korban. Rabbi Akiva says no, they were allowed to eat meat. The injunction in this pasuk is that if one has set aside an animal to be brought to the korban, it must be shechted in the Mishkan. Those were two views. But it was speaking specifically about animals set aside for kolshin, or it's talking generally that one isn't allowed to shech the door unless for a korban. And I said last night that it's all very well to understand that according to Rabbi Yishmael, then one understands a little bit of what this pasuk means. If you're not allowed to shech any animal other than for religious purposes, other than for korban, then I can understand and say it's as if you're killing a human being. Because where is the boundary line if we're going to let people kill animals? Then why not? As the vegetarians often say, if you can kill animals, why should you kill people? If you can't kill people, why should you be allowed to kill animals? So on the surface, the Torah seems to be saying, watch out. You can't kill animals, as the Rambam says. It was only allowed as a concession later on. That because people live far from the Beit HaMikdash, they couldn't bring, every time they wanted meat, they couldn't come to Yerushalayim. And therefore, it was allowed that they could eat meat out over there as well. But strictly speaking, it shouldn't have been. So the essential meaning then of this process would be that one isn't allowed to slaughter animals unless they're dedicated to the Ribbono Shel Olam. One can't just go because you want to eat, you can't go and slaughter an animal. But that isn't correct. Not correct for the simple reason that a little bit further on we learn the ish ish mibnei Yisrael min hager hagor b'seichon. Any man of the Jewish people or the ger who lived with them, asher yotsud tzeid chayo o'oy pashe yeyochel, who hunts down a kosher chayo. Now, there are chayos and there are behemoths, both are kosher. Behemoths are kosher and chayos are kosher. Behemoths are not really domestic animals, but animals capable of becoming domestic. The normal oxen and bulls and cows and sheep and goats and all that, those are behemoths. Chaya are wildebeest and kudus and springbok and impala, those are chaya. And they're kosher. But they have different halachas. You can't bring them to the Mikdash of Korban, but you're allowed to eat them. Therefore, any man who hunts, because it's so deceptive, by the way, anybody who hunts a chaya or an ox, a wild animal or a bird, which may be eaten, a kosher one, then b'shofach domoi v'chisol be'ofer. Upon spilling its blood, he must cover the blood with earth, with sand. The din of kisui hadam, which is the second halacha, which we'll be referring to in the shiur. Be that as may, we see that there was certainly, not even according to Rabbi Shmuel, according to Rabbi Akiva, according to everybody, that certainly allowed to eat hay. They were certainly allowed to eat impala and springbok and wildebeest and all those kinds of animals, and the birds, the fowl. So So if we're going to say that this is some kind of humanistic law that you shall not kill animals unless they're for korbanos, why are they allowed to eat the deer? Hi. You see, that's not the intention of the halacha. Even according to Rabbi Yishmael, who says that here there was a prohibition on the shechting of any behemoth for personal use, one could only shecht an animal if it was to be used for a korban. Nevertheless, we see that is not because there's only a narrow boundary line between killing an animal and killing a human being, that's for sure. That's not what it means at all. And we're left with our problem of last night. Last night we dealt with it along the lines of Rabbi Akiva. We'll come back to the end of the shiur. But tonight we're then left with a problem according to Rabbi Shmuel. What does it mean? So you're allowed to kill for eating any chaya or any ox. A kosher wild animal and a kosher bird, you're allowed to kill them, no problem. But if you're going to kill a domestic animal, a cow or an ox or a sheep, no, you may not kill it unless it's going to be used as a korban. And if you do, kashefet dam hagov, says Rashi. It's as if you're spilling human blood. That's the comparison. Slaughter an animal for eating it as if you're consuming human, as if you're spilling human blood. And what's the capital effect? Understand this clearly, what we're really going to learn tonight is the relationship of a Jew to his meat. The whole question of vegetarianism will be easy. To understand it, we have to go back a little bit into the history of meat eating, into the origins of man. Is it moral to eat meat or isn't it? It's an important question. People talk around the question, but very seldom do people from a Torah perspective really get to the essence of the question. Is it moral to kill an animal? If it is moral, why wasn't Odom allowed to eat meat? And if it isn't moral, why are we allowed to eat meat? Why didn't? And why is it the center of the Avodah in the Beis Hamikdash, is the bringing of animals?
Nevertheless,
Ribbono Shel Olam never allowed for eating in the beginning only plump and not Baalei Nefesh. Now the use of that word in the Rambam is really very critical. Baalei Nefesh. Nefesh doesn't mean a neshama. A neshama is this, that specific thing which a human being, which a Jew has got. The Nefesh means the life force. Now although vegetation also grows and has some form of life force, we don't call it a Nefesh. By an animal, we're already referring to it as a Nefesh. It's something semi-spiritual already. It's not just a physical being. An animal has something spiritual. It's a Baal Nefesh. And as a Baal Nefesh, he was never allowed to be consumed. Kasher bought the Pasha to Reshi Shinema, the name of Fati Lochem is called, he says, Zorea Zer. Which is giving you all grass which produces seed. The Hasher Hoyo of Amadu Shinsu of his Husu Shimrai. The Hikri Ben Korban Hoyo of Asunwe. When the flood came and the animals were saved, his Hus Noya, and he brought an acceptable sacrifice from them, he said, Lord, him Hashkit, the Bodhi Shlodom allowed Shkit. He doesn't tell us at this point why the animals were not initially allowed. And the only reason he gives for afterwards to say why the animals were allowed after the flood is because Noah saved them. Any reason, isn't it? That means that if I save another person, I can check him later on. It's mine, because if it weren't for me, it would be dead. What's the logic here? What does the Rambam mean? Because Noah saved them, this chusur they would say were not for Noah, they would be dead. Good. So the Gemara often talks about a person owing his life to another individual. Understand such a thing, but if I owe my life to another individual, that doesn't give him the right to take it back later on. So why in the case of animals? If the Ribbono Shel Olam didn't allow them because they're Baalei Nefesh, then why after the flood is man allowed to kill them? And then the Rambam goes on to explain that the blood was never allowed, not even to know. He gives two reasons why the blood was not allowed. We'll come back to these two reasons, but meanwhile, let's have them. First one, he aimed the Baal Nefesh, Sheyoichal Nefesh. It is not right for a Baal Nefesh to eat Nefesh. For a human being. To eat a nefesh, very English word, it's not a soul. It's the life force, the nefesh, but the soul of the nefesh will never be me. He had a posho is kulon mokir, because nefesh belongs to the Ribbono. That's what ours is. But again, you see, even more in the Ramadan, a certain fantasy to the life of an animal. So we now begin to understand why God never allowed it in the beginning. He never allowed an animal to be eaten because he's a Baal Nefesh. There's a fantasy to his life. After the flood, since he was only saved through the schus of Noah, he's allowed to be eaten, but not his blood, because that's his life, that's life itself. He naked Nefesh ha'odom v'chenefesh ha'behin Elohim. For behold, just like the life force of a man, so is the life force of an animal. Who mikro echot lohem. And they have one end, one ultimate day. The same happens to them. And where's their king, where's their? And this one dies, so this one dies. Ruach echot lekoh. And there's one spirit in both of them. This is beautiful ammunition for the environmentalists, for vegetarianism, and for Darwin. Not only are the bodies the same, but the nefesh is the same, says the Rambam. The same sort of thing. Talking about the shomas, talking about the nefesh, that life force. And then he goes on to a more Kabbalistic area, quoting from Aristotle, that the spark of the Ribbono Shel Olam in an animal, and that is what gives him the intuition to run away from danger. A flower can't run away from danger, it doesn't have a nefesh. And the love of a dog for its owner, almost human. is around by that. There's something special there. The nefesh. The heker mutlo b'anshe beis ba'aleim. And the way a dog recognizes members of his balabos's family. Not just his balabos. He recognizes family of the balabos, he recognizes friends of the balabos. Nefesh, that's almost human, that's not animal. Pigeons that are able to find their way, that have recognition. And therefore there's something sort of spiritual about the nefesh, which can't be eaten. That's the last of the dimension. So while the animal can be eaten, not the blood. Here's a third reason. And that is that if one does eat the blood, the qualities of the animal are absorbed into the human being. So there's three reasons which we might come back to some of that for the shiur. But let's go back to the first part of the Ramadan. It's an amazing statement that although animals were not allowed to begin with, and we now begin to understand why not, because they are violated fish, they possess a godly element to them which is not ours to consume. Nevertheless, after the flood, we were allowed to eat them. What does it mean? Here we need to go further back into the details of the history of the eating of meat. And I think that on the basis of an ikra, which I think I once spoke to you about a long time ago, on the basis of an ikra, I think one can understand what the Ramadan means. The ikra explains the development of man through his relationship with me. It's amazing ikra. The Ribbono Shel Olam said to Adam, you can eat only vegetation. Different vegetation to the vegetation that animals ate. Animals ate grass, and we ate specifically Kol Esev Zorea Zera, that vegetation which has within it seeds which can regenerate themselves. Animals don't eat seeds. The birds do. Generally, animals don't eat seeds. They eat the grass itself. We discard the grass. We eat the seeds. We eat corn. We get the seeds. Which recognizes man's superiority over the animal. The man is able to regenerate. He's created. And his food is created. The animal is not created, and it's really not created. Karin, in his university, studied what this means. The Ribbono Shel Olam says, you eat grass, the animal eats grass, but you eat a superior type of grass, a more civilized type of grass than the animal. Based on that, Karin develops a theory from which he never moves his entire life. The theory is one of equality, not of the races, but equality between animal and man. There are three sections to the material of time. There is mineral, there is vegetable, and there is animal. And that's it. Different types of animals. More clever animals, less clever animals. One evolved from the other. The theory of evolution was probably originated by Kain. He was the first one to recognize, in his opinion, that man and animal were close relatives. Came to bring a korban. He therefore says to bring a sacrifice of another animal, like bringing another human being with that. If the devotional wants a sacrifice for me, he obviously wants vegetation. Because he only gave me the right to consume vegetation. I have bias over vegetation. I have mastery over vegetation, not over the animal. Hevel, Ikrim is worried about a very fundamental. fundamental problem with heaven. We always portray heaven as the tzaddik and Kayin as the roshim. Why then on tzaddikim does Hevel survive? Does Kayin survive and Hevel dies? And we're not all descended from Hevel. Why was Hevel destroyed so early in his career if he's the tzaddik? There must have been something wrong in Hevel's philosophy as well. So they said there was very little difference between Hevel and Kayin. Hevel also believed that man is no different to animal, except just as man is master over vegetation, so God is master over animals. And although we can't eat animals, Hevel accepted that too. But when you're giving a korban to the Ebenishim, you can bring an animal. For the sake of religious purposes, you can kill an animal. Not for personal reasons, only for the Ebenishim. That's the first difference between Hevel and Kayin. Hevel believed that for religious purposes you can kill an animal, and Kayin believed you cannot kill an animal for any reason whatever. And the second difference between them was that Kayin brought not the best of the truth. It was cheap, whereas Hevel brought the best of his animals. And it was only for that reason, says the Ikri, that the Ribbono Shel Olam did not accept the korban of Kayin. Not because it was from vegetables. He would have accepted that. But because it wasn't of the best. Kayin gets upset at the rejection of his korban and goes around with a long face. The Ribbono Shel Olam picks him up for going around with a long face and says, "What are you so upset about?" And he says, Kayin was very upset by Gift with Pono that he faced a blow. By Yomer Hashem of Kayin, and Hashem says to Kayin, "Lama Cholalot, why are you angry? The Lama Nofta Falafel, why are you depressed?" The Ribbono Shel Olam challenges him on his mood. What business is this you're in a bad mood? Did you give a right to be in a bad mood? Aloyim Tetiv says, "Bein Loy Tetiv Lapeta Chatos Reve." If you will be good, you can overcome the Yetzirah. And if you don't, it will always be crouching to catch you. They lechot shukotlet, and it will always be aiming for you. They atot tim shol boy, that you have the capacity to rule over. Story. What's this going to do with all this? Kayin is upset because God hasn't accepted his korban. Why doesn't the emotional tell one of that? The reason is it wasn't good enough. Go back and bring a better one. Listen, the whole Musa Shmuel is about the Yitzharah. Your depression is closely related to your korban. You believe that you can't overpower the animal, and therefore you believe that you can't overpower the animal inside you either. And when you get miserable, when you get into a bad mood, that's animal instinct, that's not human. And if you can't get yourself out of a bad mood again, that's because you're not able to overcome your Yetzirah. No, there's a way of doing it. In Tetiv says you can uplift yourself by a high moral conduct, and you can overcome the Yetzirah, and you can overcome your visible feelings, and you can overcome your bad moods. There's no reason for you to have to submit to the animal in you, but you to have to submit to your moods. We often talked about that the human beings, the male human being, have no right whatever to give in to his moods. My goodness, that's very interesting. But I can overcome the animal part. That means we're allowed to kill animals. And after all, Hevel killed an animal and the Ribbono Shel Olam accepted it. The first animal I'm going to kill is Hevel. Because still, Kayin stands by his original principle of the equality between man and animal. And if we're allowed to kill animals, we're allowed to kill human beings. But the Ribbono Shel Olam has just taught me, says Kayin, call the Alim Kvar, get on top of it, and if your bad mood's in the way, and if the Yetzirah is in the way, destroy it, get rid of it. And if there's another animal in the way, do what the animals do, destroy it, get rid of it. And if Hevel is the source of your depression, like modern people, Kayin is not easily convinced that the source of his depression is within himself. Always looking for something outside to blame it on, and put himself on Hevel. and he's just got a heifer from the Rebbe Shimon to him. Then he goes ahead and he kills it. The Rebbe Shimon climbs down on him like a son of Jesus. Also standing up there. So I'm not. He's like, you can't kill animals. The prophet of Rebbe Shimon that you've meant that you can kill animals, you can tame animals, but not kill them. And he goes back to his original philosophy. Can't kill animals. From that he never moves away. He starts with that philosophy and all the other things revolve around that philosophy. That none of the yonshi, none of the punishment, none of the musr changes basic philosophy. Look how wrong one can think, how crooked one can be sometimes. It's the fundamentals of it. Your thinking can be straight and your logic can be straight, everything can be straight, but if your fundamentals are wrong, before you land up. And nothing caused Cain to change that fundamental, that man and animal are the same. The reason the Rebbeinu never allowed us to eat these animals. They're created for us, yet you can't eat them. Why? Because the Ramban says that Cain is an animal also has a nefesh. And you can see it in the loyalty of a dog, and in the direction finding of a pigeon, you can see that he has a nefesh. If an animal has a nefesh, so does a human being. So we're more sophisticated. Our nefesh has evolved further than the animal. That doesn't give us the right to kill an animal. Because Cain, the next thing you'll be doing is you'll kill backward people. You'll kill imbeciles. You'll kill unintelligent people. What's the difference then between one who kills animals and between a Hitler, says Cain? You either don't kill by their nefesh or you do kill by their nefesh. And that's what he oscillates through his entire career. Are you permitted to kill or aren't you permitted to kill? But to distinguish between man and animal, Cain never does. Until Noah comes along. At the time of Noah, the animal will be saved by Noah. Noah again brings a sacrifice. The sacrifice is accepted. And says the Ikrim, the Rebbeinu Shlom, is worried that we're going to go right back to square one again. And we'll be left with several philosophies. Yes, you're allowed to kill animals, but only for the sake of korban, only for sacrifice. Therefore, at the time of Noah after the flood, the Rebbeinu Shlom says you may eat animals. Any animal you like. Kosher, non-kosher, you can eat whatever you want. They're there for your purpose, they belong to you. So that there should never be any question again. The man is not master of that. Ikrim says. But Ikrim also doesn't clearly explain why it is that until that time animals were not allowed. If the Rebbeinu Shlom wanted to undo the work of Cain and Hevel, why didn't he introduce that law earlier, that you may eat animals? Why is it so critical that at the time of the flood the Rebbeinu Shlom introduced the Heter to eat meat? What changed at the time of the flood? So the Ramban says because the schus of Nitzolu, they were all saved because of the schus of Noah. What does that mean? That doesn't give you the right to eat them. I think that we have to understand Pshat in the following way. The Rebbeinu Shloim was not willing to permit the consumption of meat until man mastered animals. That had to happen first. Man had to exert his mastery over animals before the Rebbeinu Shloim would allow him to eat. Once man has mastered animals, he can eat them. Let's take the set there. And it says that in a sense, until man has mastered animals, now we're talking about the animals inside of him, that the Ikrim version says, that the version says to Cain, you are right, Cain, that man starts off as an animal. But man has the capacity to build himself into a human being and become superior to an animal. But until man has become superior to an animal, he is an animal. And one animal can't do another. It's necessary for the human being firstly to conquer his animal before he can kill another animal. And the time of Noah was the first time that the whole of humanity, more than it was at that time, but the whole of humanity had conquered the animal. Not just the animal without, but the animal within as well. The two went together. When Noah had taken the whole of the animal world and had subjected it to his discipline, because for all that time in the ark, those animals what kept Noah seder, they kept Noah's discipline. He watched them, he guarded them, he disciplined them. occasionally they weren't happy with him and they gave him a rough time some of the time. But still, he disciplined them. He had to live with them, they had to live with each other in a very confined space. That was when man for the first time learned how to dominate animals. Morally too, during that time, they reached very high standards of position, that family. They reached the ability to be able to dominate not only the animal without, but also the animal within. Once that's the case, it's a liberation, now you can enter. You can now handle the animal, you've made yourself superior to the animal, you have now earned the right to eat an animal.
Then the nefesh also would have died.
But blood also would have ceased to exist. So if you entitled it to eat the animal, why don't you entitle it to eat the blood? It all belongs to him. He said, Ramban, yes, it does all belong to him. He said, Roya Mashkita, and therefore the Ribbono Shel Olam allows us to slaughter. V'hinei hitir gufo. He allows their bodies, asher hu chai ba'avur ha'ozot, because the animal lives for man. She'yiyeh la'anosu u'dapsoliku shel ozot. That his body should be for the pleasure and benefit of the human being, not for the flesh. She'yiyeh ha'nefesh she'bohem. What about the nefesh? What about the life force? Can that be consumed too? No. That's the kapora la'ozot, the korban, the fondle his body. Moshe yifnit. That is to be used as kapora, as a permanent for the human being, when the animal is brought into the sacrifice. That may not be used. He is for a sacrifice. What does that mean? When the animal is shechted, and the korban is brought, we have with the dam, zrikat hadam. The dam, the blood is thrown up. Thrown up of his bear, thrown up of the haroshit sometimes, depends where. One particular korban that the Kohen sprinkles the blood, stirs it up, to dominate the flesh of the animal, that is shed into it. But the animal has a nefesh too, and that can't be destroyed. You'll remember from the Matzah Shabbos here 2 or 3 weeks ago. The Osir Lover, the Ribbono Shel Olam, the Gemara says, you shech the gates of Allah. Remember that? It has to be learned to shed his body. It's full of soul. Even the Yetzer Hara is in the Shoma. We discussed covered as being the Yetzer Hara in the Shoma. There are various parts of the Yetzer Hara. There are various parts of the Yetzer Hara which are spiritual and which don't get destroyed. They stick around, they stay, and the greater one gets, the more they stick to one. It's only the cracked physical part of the Yetzer Hara that one can get totally rid of. But the spiritual parts of the Yetzer Hara stick around, one can never destroy. That's something we have to learn in the animal too. You can destroy the animal, you can shech the animal, you can eat it up, you can consume it, you can burn it. There's a nefesh. And the only way you can master the nefesh is by throwing it back to the Ribbono Shel Olam. So dedicate that to the Ribbono Shel Olam. You can't destroy it. You can't eat it. You can't consume it. It's not yours. That's already bordering on the area of the spiritual. And so too with the Yetzer Hara that we have, with the negative part that we have, the animal part of us. The animal part of us also has a body and a soul. Just as we have a body and a soul, we always talk about the onion. Each section, we have a body and a soul, and our body, which is animal, also has a body and a soul. The body part of our body can be dealt with very roughly. We can master it, we can destroy it, we can handle it, we can do what we want. There's a spiritual side of our animal side. And that can't be destroyed. That has to be dedicated to the Ribbono Shel Olam. And a human being wants honor. Is that negative or is that positive? Feels humiliated. He needs honor. Is that pride or is it honor? Is it recognition or is it honor? Isn't that just be negative? The answer is pretend. It's the spiritual part of the animal desires. If we do Zrikat Hadam, if we take that and we throw it up to the Ribbono Shel Olam and we dedicate it to God, okay. If we're unable to do that, then it dominates us. It destroys us. So just as when we take a korban, there are two parts of it. There's a part of that korban that must be totally burned. There's a part of that korban that must be consumed. And there's a spiritual part of that korban which must be thrown up at the Ribbono Shel Olam. So with our Yetzer Hara, so with the animal part in every human being, there's a part which can be consumed, there's a part which can be destroyed, and there's a part which has to be dedicated to the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's why Chazal say over and over again that we have to be Eved the Ribbono Shel Olam, we have to serve God, Bishnei Yetzer Hara. You've got to use the Yetzer Hara in your Avodas Hashem. You can't destroy it, certainly. You can destroy the physical part, and I've always wondered that Chazal is against other Chazal. You've talked about destroying the Yetzer Hara, and here we talk about serving God with the Yetzer Hara. What is it? The physical part of the Yetzer Hara we destroy. The spiritual part of the Yetzer Hara we serve the Ribbono Shel Olam. What about Chayim? What about the rule of Yitzchak? What do we do with Israel? Egypt, we call the Nefesh. Bring it to the Kosher, the abortion doesn't want it. That creates a problem. Why? Is his unwillingness to submit to human discipline. That's a chayim. A behemoth is sometimes wild, sometimes disciplined, but is willing to submit to discipline. You just have to say it. A chayim is not willing to discipline. You might ask, what about circus lions and things like that? Who wants to see that? Firstly, you notice that when they bring the circus lions in, they're still like the fencer. Nobody trusts the circus lions too well. And even the trainer goes in with a sticking head. Always a little bit suspicious. The lion is always a lion underneath the door. And if he's not, if the trainer goes in and there's no fence and he has no stick and he's got no gun in his pocket, he doesn't know they're not real lions. They come from the zoo, they come from the Michigan, as we discussed last week. They're not real lions. And he's either a lion, in which case there's a reason to be fearful, or he's not a lion. But you can't tame him and he remains a lion. An ox, a bull, a cow, a lamb, you can tame it and in no way detracts from its inherent quality. It doesn't make it most lamb if it's tamed. But so it is willing to be tamed. It doesn't detract. It's not against its nature to become tame. It's against the lion's nature to tame him. Simply by the shlomo. Animal that is not willing to submit itself to human discipline, I don't want this blood out. And he has no spiritual rights over him. Wonderful. He doesn't come here to be there. Here we have a new kind of Yeshvara. We've got the Yeshvara, a little hype. We've got the human being, there's an animal part to him. And it's wild, but it can be disciplined. And it wants to be disciplined. And the ways of discipline takes it, one handles it. The physical part one destroys, and the spiritual part one channels. But the Bildechai, you get a human being who's not willing to submit himself, there's nothing you can do with the spiritual part either. You can destroy the physical part, and the spiritual part, you have to destroy that, you destroy everything. You cannot channel such a human being. What do you do with it? Blood, Kisui Hagan, is buried. It has no constructive part to display, whatever. You may not consume it, nor may you use it for anything positive. It has no redeeming features. It must be left aside and buried. Very often, people confuse the real type with individuality. And very often they confuse a willingness to discipline oneself with docility. And they're very different. Docility is a drugged rhinoceros. That's a better time. You've seen pictures of these rhinoceros, after they've drugged them to bring them to zoos or whatever, or to do research on them. That's a docile animal. An ox is a submissive animal. An impala is a wild animal. It's different. A human being who is docile to his drugs, a human being who is not willing to think for himself. He wants a Rebbe. But he wants a Rebbe who is going to tell him what to do so that he can relieve himself of all responsibility. It's like the drug rhinoceros. There are such human beings in Baruch Hashem that people are capable. He has either kind of a human being. I want to be disciplined. I'm willing to be mevatel myself in order to be taught how to discipline myself. I don't want somebody else to do the job for me. I'm willing to go through a process of intellect. I'm willing to discipline myself in order to do that. And one finds the example in the Hasidic world, where today there's a lot more of this, of the willingness to submit. One finds the two types of people. One finds the two types of rabbis. One finds Hasidim Mahan Hasidim were very wonderful and know how to use it. But he must submit himself, but not to aggregate his arrogant responsibilities so quickly to him. And that's the difference between one willing to be submissive and one who is docile. One is docile to whom they said, shoot the dragon to me. And carry me, put me where I'm supposed to be at the right time. And I finish there, take me where I'm supposed to be. Tell me what to do and I'll do what I do. The other human being says, I want to be taught. I want to understand. I'm going to question. I'm going to ask and I'm going to think for myself. But I'm prepared to put myself under you. I'm prepared to put myself in your care. I find that a doctor finds it a patient sometimes. A patient who comes in the hospital and buys a person and things you want to do. And some doctors like that. Easier to get off of the job when they stick tubes up. Knows more medicine than the doctor knows. It's because he wants to participate. He wants to feel a bit of a match also. He wants to retain his dignity. And he retains his dignity by entering into dialogue and diversity. And he's also a little bit of a motherboss. And a clever doctor will say to him, will give him the opportunity to make choices. And will say to him, you know, we can do A or we can do B. I feel inclined towards A for the following reasons. What do you think? Would you prefer procedure B? These are the advantages, these are the disadvantages. And 9 times out of 10 the patient will opt for what the doctor has advised. But his human dignity is with us. He decides. He is a sticker about a book. He's not a docile rhinoceros. And so it is in our word of Hashem, it's our servant. A person is not willing to submit himself to a rabbi. A person is not willing to submit himself to a discipline in his learning, in his thinking, in his hanhoge. Why then? A person who's willing to submit himself to the point where he gives up responsibility is a docile. But the Rebbeinu Shlomo accepts is the shoyr cheter of the ace. The animal which is capable of being domesticated. He can be channeled, he can be controlled, and he can be brought to the code. The Bilbechai, the animal who thinks my individuality remains in running away from any form of discipline, as soon as you come here, you run. That's a real defiance. We cannot develop refinement. We cannot develop sensitivity. We cannot develop straightness of thought. And is totally rejected as having any part to play in that relationship. And so, yes, he can be used. And according to Rabbi Yishmael, he can be used in the midbar itself. No problem. And he can be used as meat for your father and the wildebeest. But not for religious purposes. Don't confuse. Don't think he has a part to play in Kiddush. You want to eat him, relating physical to physical. Your body needs his body, shecht him and eat him. But don't try and elevate it into some superior act and some kind of supernatural act. It has no religious connotations at all. And so with our human wildebeest, it's the same thing. He needs Yiddishkeit, he needs it for his pride, he needs it for himself, he needs it. Let him do what he wants. But let him never think, and let anybody else ever think, that he's going to become an Olam Kodesh, that he's going to develop sanctity, and that he's going to develop refinement. That won't be possible, as long as he remains a Yiddishkeit. Let's then go back to our domestic animal. To the animal which can be domesticated. Now we come according to Rabbi Shmuel from the time of the Midbar. If he is brought and shechted for the purpose of eating, it's as if a human being has been killed. The shechted dog also is higher than us. Why is that? And then the Chiddush in the way of Rabbi Yishmael. When you're dealing with the domestic animal, there is inevitably a religious aspect. Because you can only shed the physical body, you're left with the blood, inevitably. And the blood has a religious part to play. That's why we don't do Kisui Hadam on the Talabarim. The domesticated animal, we don't bury the blood. Why? Because the blood has a purpose to play. Don't push it aside. The blood is meant for the Mizbeah. It has tremendous sanctity. Don't just push it away. And even though you're allowed to eat it, at times the Israelites have been allowed to eat meat without having to bring the blood to the Beit HaMikdash. But at that time, that's essentially the meaning, we'll follow the Ramban's view, that it was only a concession that they were allowed to eat meat. But inherently, no, strictly speaking, we should not be allowed to eat behemoths. You can eat chayim. But in a behemoth, there is inevitably an aspect of religious sacrifice in the shedding of a behemoth. Because the blood remains. It's interesting that bullfighting, which is a very spiritual thing, it's quite a human sport. It's not authentic. It represents the domination of the human being over the Yetzirah. That's our stuff, that's what it's all about. The ability to submit, to bring one single-handed, to bring a wild animal to total submission. That's the game of bullfighting. We play bullfighting too, but we don't do it that way. We do it with a telling pitch. We bring the animals in code. Or we shift the animal in the other side. Anytime we take an animal capable of domestication, or with such animals we have an identification, we're a little bit akin to them. We're distant from trade animals, very distant. From the kosher highest, we're also quite distant. We don't like them in terms of their meaning. But when it comes to domestic animals, we feel very much of a closeness, very much of an affinity. We recognize something. When we look at a bull, we recognize something. That wild power, willing to be dominated and willing to be tamed, willing to serve the human being. We look at a bull and we see ourselves in the mirror. It's the most amazing thing if we're sensitive enough. Oh, look at that. Just like me. Wild. Willing to be tamed and willing to serve the Ribbono Shel Olam. But how do you do it? And if one sees the bull in that way, one says one's a bracha and one takes one's chalut and one shechts it, and the bull finally submits. Such spiritual accomplishment in that unit. Is that the spirituality that she could call them? And that's why essentially it wasn't permitted to be done outside the Beis HaMikdash. Why not? There we come back to the story last night. Come out of that, you swear that you can work exactly the same way. The fact is, whenever you share a show or a chesed or an ace, there is a spiritual element, there's a religious element. There is an aspect of korban, according to Rabbi Shimon. According to Rabbi Akiva, no, it's the same. If you're slaughtering it for yourself, it's the same with the pious. But if you're slaughtering it as a korban, then it has to follow certain rules. According to Rabbi Shimon, no. Whenever you slaughter an animal with which you identify, and therefore an animal which is qualified to come onto the Mizbeah, there is a certain religious relationship, a certain spiritual dialogue, so to say, going on between man and beast. And that dialogue has to take place just the inside the Mishkan, not out in the animal. That's the last one. Yes, the wild bull can be tamed and must be tamed, because he can't be tamed out in the field. If you want to tame the wild animal, the first thing you have to do is bring it into the crowd. You've got to come into your area. An enclosed area. Put up a fence. You've got an Indian Dory. You've got to, immediately he comes in, he's got to recognize already. Hey, there's no kidding, so I can't go where I want to. There's a discipline. And his first relationship with discipline is the understanding of limitations. There are fences. And the bull comes into the bullfighter. Even before he sees the bullfighter, he looks around and he sees. I can only go so far, but never to rest. That one needs to understand. That the taming of the bull has to take place in a strictly structured environment, not out in the wild. Here we start talking again about the bull is tied to human being without it. Just as you can't tame the bull out there, so you can't tame the human being out there. There's confusion after last night's shooting because some people thought I was intending to say it, that when you're out in the wild, you can be a Buddha. When you come to the base of Medrash, you'd be a human being, that's for sure. All I'm saying is that you can be successful out in the wild as a human being, only if the Buddha has been tamed. That you're a mensch when you go out into the wild. But if the Buddha hasn't been tamed when you go out into the wilds, you're still a Buddha. Or perhaps more of a gorilla, because you look like a human being. And that's something that has to be understood. One looks often, one finds in good people, you see them behaving in the business world with uselessness, crude, against the Torah. See, when it comes to Shul, all of a sudden, it's different. It shuffles and it shakes. And he dabbles with his tongues over his head. And he learns. And he lets somebody else walk through the door before him. Bench. Turns out into the wild, into the business jungle, and he's a businessman. With all the ruthlessness and wickedness that business allows and tolerates. The answer is that a human being whose bull has never been tamed is just he's a bull in disguise, but he remains a bull. He remains a wild animal. It's only once the wild animal has been tamed that one can go into one's physical world and relate there with Kedusha. That one can go into the secular world and relate there with Kedusha. That one can go into one's family and relate there with Kedusha. An extremely worrying thing going on in Johannesburg at the moment. It's going on in the rest of the world to a greater extent. But South Africa has somehow in the past been protected from such things for various reasons. And that is an alarming increase in the religious delinquency. Religious people are meeting with lawyers and with psychologists and with psychiatrists, sometimes true, sometimes not true, I'm talking about the professionals, very often goy, very often non-Jews, for the most unbelievable behavior. Husbands beating up wives, husbands and wives unfaithful to one another, theft, fraud, all sorts of things. Religious people sitting there in the lawyer's office with the undercover. The lawyer still said to one recently, "Why can't you beat up your wife? You're a religious man." Starts quoting in Gemaras to show him how it's allowed. So simple. So we're good. And I'm beginning to get this feedback from the professionals. What is this religion? Is this really what goes on? That every single day I'm getting it, not once a week or once a month, every single day. And a shyness from a lawyer this week. A fruit person living in this area, whose name I don't know, and is not from our community, sitting in the lawyer's office with a yarmulke on, asks the lawyer a shayla because he's embarrassed to go to a rabbi. What is the shayla? Is he permitted to lend his girlfriend, his secretary, money to have an abortion on? The baby is his, he's married. That's his shayla. All of a sudden it's tight. Didn't have a shayla, was he allowed to have an affair with her or not? That's not the shayla. Can I now lend her money? A religious man, shomer shabbos, shomer mitzvahs, goes to shiurim, sitting this week in the lawyer's office. That's his shayla. What do you find? Most people don't have the means with which to understand such apparitions. I told you, I don't know if it was a Shabbos shiur or another shiur of the Shekel Matter in New York, around the brothel, from girls. Had my prostitute goes to the mikvah. A kosher prostitute, the Mahadri. That's what they do. She's justified. Quite accepted. And her counterpart in Manhattan appears on television and says, "Ah, shake it, ah, shiksa, what kind of nonsense is that?" On television. Kind of business, a big beard, a big black hat, on television in New York. What kind of business? How can she say such a thing to use Jewish girls for that? In my brothel, I use non-Jewish girls. Much more kosher. Open. Realize what this is all coming to? It wasn't long ago where you could assume that if you were doing business with a true person, you didn't have to ask for it as a contract. You assumed there was honesty. You knew you weren't getting an effective article. So why would you be a religious person? Not so anymore. Yiddishkeit, from Yiddishkeit, has become a society. It doesn't mean anything. It used to be an elite. It used to have the ordinary Jews, and the elite became true. It was difficult to be true. It required the serious nefesh to be true. That's what it used to be. Today it's not so. The elite can be true, and people do it for all sorts of reasons and fashion. But it no longer is in any way an indication of the moral caliber of the religious person. No matter how long his coat and how big his hat or how long his beard or how long the tail is, it is no indication whatever that that isn't still a wild bull that hasn't trained us. Because at the end of it, the Muslim is required. If he is not prepared to be the battle himself, you know you're dealing with a wild animal. He might be a wild animal dressed in civilized clothes, but a wild animal it is. He is. And the first thing you ask a person, a true person when you meet him now, is Rabbi Yitz, who's your Rebbe? Not where did you learn, it doesn't mean anything. I learned from Konovich, I learned from Gates, I learned from Lear, I learned from Lake. That means I sat in a building. It doesn't answer your question. Who's your Rebbe? And he gives you the answer, he says, so and so. The next question is, were you the battle of yourself to him? Did you subject yourself to him? And you said, for how long? Well, how did you? 5 years, 10 years, subject myself, he started telling you the stories of how he subjected himself. And if you really need to know, because you're getting into a business deal, you check up if it's true. One person, when I asked him that, Rosh Hashiva, but I suspected him of dishonesty. So I said to him, it was a business matter. I said, who's your Rebbe? He told me all the stories, and he repeated terror from his Rebbe. Wonderful. Come, I'll learn with you. I repeat some of my Rebbe's terror. And we sat and learned. It was the most wonderful experience. A London, unbelievable. Still remember the Gemara being beautiful. So I checked up with the family of his Rosh Hashiva. His Rosh Hashiva was there, as usually is the case in these situations. Is it true that Reb So-and-so was a Talmud of your father? I said, yes, depends what you mean Talmud. He used to come to the Shiurim for many years, and he understood my father's Torah. You should know when he used to come and visit, my father used to lock the cupboards. That's a demonstration. People should never see, people saw that one day this person would go around saying he's a Talmud of mine, and so it should be absolutely clear. He used to get up from his seat and walk around slowly and deliberately. Before he sat down to learn, lock all the cupboards and put the keys in his pocket. Then he used to smile. The man had such a thick skin, he never even picked it up. So I have to be careful in checking up. So it turned out this Rosh Hashiva aligned it. Turned out afterwards, is a rogue wanted by the police in several countries. Rosh Hashiva, a Talmud of a great man. A wild bull rat. Never learned, never submitted himself, and never subjected himself. A wild fire. Therefore one has to know that one can't train the bull out in the fields. One's going to train the bull. The bull has to be brought into a structured environment. And I know that this place of Medrash is misunderstood by many. I know the things that are said about it. And I take exceptionally great pleasure every time I hear those things said. Because I know it's being recognized for what itself, what it is. It's being misunderstood, fine. Not everybody's worthy of understanding it. But at least it's being recognized for what it is. There's a discipline for a Hashem. Self-imposed discipline. One thing I've always said, I never require anybody to be part of it. I'm happy to close it tomorrow. It'll be a relief. That's what the Rebbeinu Shlomo wants. I have no objection whatever. If each individual decides, I don't want it. It's not for me. I have a place in it. Only with pleasure that each person can tell me, get himself fixed up somewhere else, and lock the doors and sell the building. No problem. Doesn't bother me at all. That in no way do I require of anybody to come. The only thing is if you want to come, know what you're coming to. course there's a discipline, and there's going to be a discipline. There's a discipline which needs to become a self-discipline. Of course there's a structure. Of course there's a savior. Of course I demand respect for that savior. Of course I don't want to see that savior undermined. Just as Rupsinkhazusel said to the young man who jumped over the fence, if you're able to jump over the fence, you'll never be a mensch. If you have no respect for the fence, if you don't understand what it means, of course there are fences that are meant not to be jumped over. That's what the space of Medrash is. That's what the Basa Medrash of my Yeshivas were. That's what the Yeshivas were. That's what my father's home was. That's what my great uncle's educational system was. That's how I grew up, and that's the only way I'm authorized to teach Torah. Anywhere I will. The rule needs to be brought in. If you're going to shift, going to the Shita of Rabbi Yishmael, not outside. Because if you shift outside, if you're going to take your religion outside only, if you're never going to bring the bull into the Beit HaMikdash, if you're never going to subject the bull to the rigorous disciplines of Kodshim and of the Beit HaMikdash, where every step is controlled, if the bull is never going to have that taming, and kashefech dom ha'odah, a bull can kill. A bull can be docile, but a bull can kill. And know how close you are to murder. You'll murder with your tongue, and you'll murder with your hands. You'll destroy yourself, you'll destroy others, and you'll destroy Yiddish. If the bull is going to be used for religious purposes, and every bull needs to be used for religious purposes, has to have time when it's brought into the structure, not only outside. But of course, once the bull is being tamed and has been tamed and is regularly tamed, of course it's no longer bull, now you've got a balabos, and of course it has to go back into the world outside, and of course it has to introduce kedusha into everything that happens there. It is able to introduce kedusha without the constant battle of the wild bull. And whenever the bull starts becoming wild again, if the bull attacks you, back to the Beis HaMedrash. But it doesn't help getting to a Beis HaMedrash where there are no rules. It doesn't help getting to a Beis HaMedrash where Sforim are strewn all over the place, where you don't know what time the davening starts. It starts whenever people happen to be there. You don't know whether there is a shir or there isn't. It makes a difference if you've prepared your Gemara or you haven't prepared your Gemara. That's not a Beis HaMedrash. That has no capacity to tame a bull. If Moshchil the Beis HaMedrash, if you find the bull's getting the better of you, Moshchil the Beis HaMedrash, take him to a disciplined Beis HaMedrash, where there is a Seder and where it's understood. Feel it. That freezing cold day in the winter, when Hillel didn't have enough money to come into the Beis HaMedrash. Do you think had he gone up to the keeper of the Beis HaMedrash and said, Rabbi Yid, I don't have money for you. You know whenever I've come I've given half my income to you. I don't have a penny. Not for me, not for you and not for me. My family have also got money. But Shmaya and Artanyan are giving a shear and I'm not going to miss that shear. Rabbi Yid, please let me. I'll make it up to you. Do you think the Shomer of Beis HaMedrash would have said, no, sorry, can't come in. Who would have kept Hillel out of the shir of Shmaya and Artanya? Hillel doesn't do it. Hillel goes up onto the roof, puts his ear to the fanlight, and gets covered by feet, meters of snow during the storm, listening to the shir. Why not get to the shir of the Beis HaMedrash and get in? There are rules in the Beis HaMedrash. The rules are you pay. If I break that rule, says Hillel, this is no longer a Beis HaMedrash. Rules are not there to be broken, rules are there to be submitted to. And this bull is going to be tamed by lying on top of that family. Don't get into the Beis HaMedrash if you're not able to conform to those rules. Of course, we're talking in this case about rules which are halakhically orientated. We're not talking about stupidity, we're not talking about becoming obsessive, we're not talking about becoming inflexible, we're not talking about ridiculous things. We're talking about rules that have the yisoidus and chinuch and musr in halach. Rules for which there is a mesoidus, rules for which there is a tradition. Rules that have existed in yeshivas and basa medrash for centuries and centuries. Those are the rules we're talking about. Rules of tahara and kedusha. Rules of purity and sanctity. For only they can take the wild bull and turn the meeting and turn it into an Ishai weekly meeting.